Muchas gracias, Vivian, por esta charla muy provocativa y fascinante. Y me gustó mucho que incluso hablaste de los cosas básicos. Entonces, para realmente recordar de qué se entiende poner el liberalismo, la evolución histórica y hasta el día de hoy. Entonces, tenemos, digamos, unos 20 minutos para preguntas, para comentarios a la charla de Vivian. Entonces, quisiera abrir un espacio para comentarios, preguntas. ¿Quién quisiera hacer un? Adelante. Si puede, por favor, identificar su nombre e institución, si no es de la CEPAL.
Me llamo Ramón Gelaber, trabajo en la Fundación para la Superación de la Pobreza. If you don't mind, I would like to ask in Spanish. Okay. ¿Pero puedo hablar en español? Sí. Yo soy un inmigrante español en Chile. Vengo del sur, de los Peaks. Allí se habla, en el sur de Europa se habla prácticamente de la necesidad de un nuevo pacto social, ¿ya? Como el que se establece, digamos, en la Segunda Guerra Mundial y que da pie a los estados de bienestar, según me lo explicaron a mí. Lo que pasa es que para mí el problema de la resistencia del neoliberalismo es precisamente la ausencia de alternativa y la ausencia de una izquierda clara, ideológicamente una izquierda, ¿ya? Es decir, cuando se establece el pacto, después de la Segunda Guerra Mundial, se establece también ante un peligro rojo, ¿no? Ante el temor de que ciertos países europeos caigan en la órbita socialista. Ahí me recuerda un poco la frase de, recuperando también a un humanista español, a Francisco de Vitoria, que dice, se pacta libremente, pero se obliga al pacto. Es decir, ese primer pacto que se produce en Europa tras la Segunda Guerra Mundial se hace de alguna manera coaccionada entre, no sé, los ciudadanos, los trabajadores y las grandes élites, ¿ya? No sé si es un pacto o una tregua que se rompe después, ¿ya? Entonces, ¿cómo es posible que ahora lleguemos a un pacto, un nuevo pacto social, cuando realmente no hay fuerzas antagónicas? Porque de un lado no hay nada. Preguntan aquí dónde están los socialdemócratas. Los socialdemócratas son neoliberales, usted lo dijo. Los socialdemócratas fueron en muchos casos los que implementaron las políticas neoliberales en mi país también. Felipe González era socialista y fue el que introduce las grandes medidas neoliberales en España, ¿no? Entonces, bueno, lo mío era un análisis, no una pregunta. Pero quizás va por ahí, o sea, es decir, ¿cómo podemos hacer frente al neoliberalismo construyendo una izquierda de verdad, que no existe? Que está otras cosas, que no sé qué hace. Y que yo, por lo que decía antes, me resisto a pensar que puedan ser los socialdemócratas, en tanto en cuanto encuentro que son neoliberales ya.
Muy bien, vamos a colectar como tres o cuatro preguntas antes de pasar la palabra a Vivian. Adelante.
Hola, sí, yo soy Rosana Castiglioni de la Universidad Diego Portales. Tengo dos preguntas. Una es que usted mismo reconocía al inicio de su exposición que el concepto de neoliberalismo está supercargado, ¿no? Suele ser adjetivado, suele traer una carga consigo. Y me interesa saber si al interior del equipo que trabajaron este libro discutieron la posibilidad de usar conceptos alternativos más neutros, tipo pro market o algo por el estilo, ¿no? Pro mercados o etcétera. Y la otra pregunta tiene que ver con potencial explicación alternativa a la resiliencia del neoliberalismo. Y algo que yo trabajo políticas sociales, reformas de políticas sociales y el impacto de las ideas en las reformas de políticas sociales, etcétera. Y algo que aparece en varios sectores es como la aversión al riesgo y la aversión a invertir costos para financiar una reforma. Y a veces, más que grandes debates ideológicos, tiene que ver con cuánto va a costar financiar una alternativa. Y el neoliberalismo está asociado a recursos escasos, digamos, o, no sé, focalización en materia de políticas sociales, o qué sé yo, que suele ser mucho más barato que unas políticas centradas en una intervención fuerte del Estado, ¿no? Entonces, mi pregunta es si no hay algo de risk adversity o de aversión al riesgo y de costos asociados a reformar.
¿Alguien más quise? Bueno, Ana, tal vez.
Bueno, para hacer algunas alusiones a la situación en América Latina, digamos, hablando estrictamente de ideas, la importancia del contexto político en Chile para que los planteamientos neoliberales en materia de política social fueran más netamente llevados a la práctica debido a, digamos, a la manera en que se engarzaron ideas neoliberales que se desarrollaron antes de la dictadura y que permitieron la existencia de estos ideólogos y que luego se insertaron muy adecuadamente con el gobierno de Pinochet. Entonces, qué interesante cómo ideas muy claramente neoliberales fueron un laboratorio llevado a la práctica, incluso de manera innovadora. Digamos, Thatcher quería golpear muy fuertemente el National Health Service inglés y no lo logró en la manera en que lo logró Pinochet, sino más bien en esta manera híbrida en que nos dice Vivian en el caso del NHS, la introducción de cuasimercados en la onda thatcheriana. Mientras que Pinochet destruyó, digamos, el sistema en tanto solidario, en tanto universal, se implantó un sistema dual. Y en lo de pensiones ni siquiera existía. Hoy nos parece tan normal porque es complementario en varios países y porque en otros también tan único como Chile, pero no existía un sistema de cuentas individuales de pensiones como perspectiva de pilar medular de un sistema de pensiones. Entonces, eso se implanta acá. Tiene influencia, irradia hacia otros lados, pero más hibridizado, como por ejemplo en Colombia, donde se implanta una reforma de salud que aprende de Chile y que quiere, digamos, ir más allá de esa dualidad o individualismo y pone un fondo solidario, etcétera, pero igual competencia en la provisión, competencia en el aseguramiento en Colombia. Pero qué interesante esto que nos dice Vivian de cuando los políticos niegan la implementación e incluso entonces como que se distancian por aquello de los fracasos o de lo que ocurre en la implementación. Tú hablabas de benefits of non-implementation. Y yo creo que en Chile la crisis del sistema de protección actual es muy interesante porque tiene sus raíces, digamos, en las luchas de los estudiantes que ponen en el centro de la discusión la articulación de los sistemas de políticas sociales en lo que se refiere a educación y también en protección social, articulados por el lucro y la problemática que eso tiene. Entonces hay toda esa capacidad de ese movimiento muy propositivo y muy con un discurso comunicativo, como dice Vivian, muy potente, pero también se pone en duda porque ya los sectores medios y tal están sufriendo en sus propios cuerpos lo que es la implementación de esas reformas, ¿verdad? Entonces lo que sonaba muy lindo, la hotelería de las ISAPRES, sonaba muy bonito, ir a los hospitales que no eran tan feos como los públicos, etcétera, pero resulta que te vuelves viejo o tienes una enfermedad crónica y esos son los que te tienen que recibir. O las pensiones, no, esas pensiones, ese sistema horrible de pensiones antes, tan fragmentado, tan malito, no, yo voy a tener una cuenta individual y resulta que las tasas de reemplazo son bajísimas y entonces las pensiones son muy malas. Entonces, ¿cómo la implementación se está experimentando en carne propia en Chile lleva a un cuestionamiento muy profundo, digamos, de esa articulación de ideas neoliberal que comienza también en ese plano ideológico a hacer agua y que permite entonces una interacción entre actores sociales muy diversos?
Antes de pasar la palabra a Vivian por un comentario final, quisiera agregar dos preguntas. Primero, con respecto a las resiliencias de justamente los, de las ideas, ¿cuáles de los 5 factores, no sé si en el libro se dice algo, estiman ustedes que predomina? Y lo que yo escuché, pero tal vez es un sesgo propio mío, es el énfasis que tú pusiste en el interest group. Yo vi con mi hijo, que es muy antisistema y que le gusta mucho tener una visión crítica a la sociedad, la película The Four Horsemen, y que ahí hay un cuento muy bonito de justamente cómo todo el sistema político está capturado por grupos de intereses, los banqueros, las grandes multinacionales, y que a partir de ahí nunca va a surgir un cambio, porque estamos en un círculo vicioso donde es muy difícil salir. Eso era la primera pregunta. Y la segunda es un factor que no mencionaste, que podría producir un cambio, y que es la emergencia de los países del sur, los países BRICS. Ya China se convirtió en la mayor economía del mundo en términos de paridad de poder de compra, pero también hay otras economías, India, Brasil, y esos actores no podrían constituir un cambio a este paradigma. Gracias. Okay, bueno, una pregunta final, breve, a dos. Por favor, si puede ser breve.
Yeah. Hello. Yeah. Thank you very much for this reviving speech and conference about neoliberalism. I'd just like to point out 2 things. First of all, from talking about the Washington consensus, I'm just having trouble understanding how, okay, well, during the 80s, Thatcher and Reagan implemented those conservative policies, and then Chile started in the 80s as well, but really the concept of Washington consensus became such around 1989, 1990, the Washington Conference by Williamson. And initially it was a 10-point package that was actually used as a medicine for the ills of the 1980s, like known as the last decade, I mean in the case of Latin America, or the debt-led growth. And I'm wondering, how did this supposedly temporary remedy become a universal concept? How did it become an actual a plan for the long term? So how do we get from one side to the other? And my other point is, having studied political science mainly, we're always on about concepts and ideas as such, but do we really have to draw a line between neoliberalism and social democracy? Does it have to be black or white? Is it not possible to have a mix of heterodox and orthodox policies, for example, or to still implement neoliberal economic policies while at the same time having a focus on social policy? So yeah, thank you very much.
Este será el último comentario, por favor, si puede ser.
Sí. Sí. Lo que me interesaba destacar es cómo en general, en la literatura referida a neoliberalismo y en particular reformas.
Disculpe, ¿se puede presentar, por favor?
Sí, Gustavo Rayo, de la Universidad de Talca. ¿Cómo, en definitiva, todo ese proyecto de reformas, o más bien dicho, la materialización de muchas de las ideas neoliberales, normalmente se presentan como asociados en su origen, evidentemente, al mundo anglosajón? Y sin embargo, lo cierto es que la materialización de las reformas neoliberales se inician en concreto en Chile, a partir del año, diríamos, 78, es decir, antes de los 80. Pero aquí obedeció fundamentalmente a una, podríamos decir, tenía una componente, diríamos, política fundamental, institucional fundamental, es decir, se justifican en función de una interpretación de la crisis del sistema democrático en Chile. Es decir, los argumentos neoliberales en nuestro país, expresados los principales articuladores intelectuales, ideológicos, de las reformas o del proyecto de modernizaciones sociales a partir del año 78, 78, se van a justificar en función de una crisis, en función de una interpretación particular de la crisis del sistema democrático que lo asociaba básicamente a el exceso de intervencionismo estatal, pero también a la democracia de masas y al rol de los partidos políticos como articuladores de una democracia de masas que enfrentaba a un Estado con incapacidad redistributiva en función de su nivel de acumulación de capital. Y por lo tanto, no es extraño que las reformas económicas le sigan las reformas sociales, de las cuales hablaban a Soho, previsión, educación, salud, antes las reformas económicas, pero para concluir en reformas políticas, es decir, como tres etapas de un proceso perfectamente coherente que ha logrado, a lo largo de más de 20 años de retorno de la democracia, una gran estabilidad desde el punto de vista de sus bases fundamentales. Entonces, yo creo que uno de los casos más interesantes de analizar justamente es la experiencia chilena, cuando la analizamos de una perspectiva institucional. Entonces, la pregunta sería, si acaso efectivamente ese Beyond Europe solamente se concentra en Estados Unidos, o en definitiva no les ha interesado tomar como punto de referencia Chile, particularmente en un momento en que por primera vez se está poniendo en cuestión justamente las fases fundamentales de ese modelo.
Vivian, the floor is yours for the final comments.
Okay, thank you so much for all of these really interesting comments. And in some cases, many are beyond what I can answer in the context of this talk. Because remember, I said that we're talking about ideas, neoliberal ideas, and I wanted to look at the source of neoliberal ideas. And lots of the questions were, how does this get translated into practice? So I'm going to try to answer, but note that that's really beyond what this project was about and what I was trying to help us think through. And that is that, you know, whether we're talking what happens in Chile, what happened in Chile, what happens, you know, whether it's social democracy versus neoliberalism or together with neoliberalism, in what I was trying to do is say, what you had was a group of people, largely men, actually, writing about essentially imagining creating this thing called neoliberalism. There are many different variants, many different kinds of, let's call them economic philosophers who have these ideas. They're basically marginalized outside, but they are generating these ideas. They're training people. They are circulating these ideas. They are communicating these ideas. And at some point, a point in the early 70s, when you have a massive crisis, they come in and say, we know the answer, and neo-Keynesianism doesn't work. And certain politicians then take up these ideas, Reaganomics, which Reagan's own budget director in the OME said was, you know, and who actually implemented it for the first 2 years, David Stockman, then writes a book and says, you know, this is all voodoo. I mean, it really is ridiculous. But okay. These become the way in which political actors figure out that this is the way, maybe this will be the answer. You actually get kinds of incremental reforms. I mean, I'm not going to give you the whole history, but in 73, 74, it's the Bundesbank that says, we're not going to do anything neo-Keynesian. And anyway, we never have. And in 73, 74, they keep their hard, they reinforce their hard money policy, and unemployment goes massively up. But within a couple years, when the second oil crisis hits, they say, Germany actually does much better than anyone else who'd done Keynesian pump priming, and people say, maybe neoliberal ideas work. And, you know, all of a sudden Milton Friedman and monetarism, which actually subsequently was disproved, comes in And Margaret Thatcher picks it up, etc. Interesting that Anna said that, and you're absolutely right, that Thatcher tries, she actually manages to reform macroeconomic policy. That's her first focus. She then does business by, through privatization. The welfare state, she actually fails because she uses a discourse of the feckless and the idle versus, you know, the worthy poor. But she hits a stone wall because people actually like their benefits. They like the national health insurance. They like the universal pension system. And it's the Social Democrats who come in. It's Blair who managed to make it work with a different variant of neoliberalism, a more social democratic variant, where he layers on the notion of opportunity. So whereas Thatcher talks about the feckless and the idle, Blair talks about welfare is not a hand out, but a hand up. It's not a hammock, but a trampoline. And he basically succeeds in creating Thatcher's revolution in terms of welfare. Very interesting the way, and this is why I keep talking about the different kinds of variants of neoliberalism and the social democrats. I mean, and think about the poor social democrats. They were going to be out of office forever. Neoliberalism seemed the only ideas in town, and they think, okay, how can we be good social democrats and get elected? Clinton in the US following Reagan, et cetera. Well, actually others, but Blair following, you know, 17 plus years of Tory rule. Well, the people were convinced. Everyone was convinced that the people were convinced that this was, that neoliberalism was here. And so they layered on a different kind of, you know, what they thought was social democracy, social democratic policy ideas on top of a deep philosophy. Well, it turns out the deep philosophy is what remained stronger. But, you know, in terms of we need a left, yes. I mean, what's interesting in the U.S., if you think about it, the U.S. has drifted so far right. You know, and each time, you know, you think it can't get more right, and then, you know, the Tea Party comes up. So much so that Nixon looks like a left-wing radical. You know, and he did all the various social policies, environmental policy, occupational safety and health, whole range of things that, you know, this looks radical. Okay, but in terms of the left, I mean, one of the problems, you could argue, is the collapse of the Soviet Union. However bad it was some kind of, at least they believe in equality, or at least there's this alternative, call it Marxism, call it communism, even if they didn't do it right. And that, I mean, I think the analysis in the post-war period was absolutely right. That created, forced a compromise in between. But you note, I said, big ideas, but what happens in the policy world is not the big ideas, but the sort of the, you know, let's talk about the intervening variables in between. Talk about the interest-based coalitions, the workers versus, well, what neoliberalism has done is it has essentially destroyed the power of the workers in most countries. If you think about the deregulation of labor markets, especially in liberal market economies like the US, the UK, etc., unions are no longer the force. What's interesting, though, is, I mean, you shouldn't despair, because ideas have a way of being important even if they don't get implemented at first. The indignados, Occupy, and the whole notion of the 1%. How do we explain that Piketty has become such a, you know, a guru or star? I mean, he's got real star power, drawing power. You know, this is a really very thick, heavy book that's almost unreadable, is unreadable. But everyone has it on their coffee table to say, you know, affichage, we believe that inequality is bad. This is about, it's not just, I mean, the question about the power, you know, which one is it, the power of interest? Interests change their minds. You tell business interests, watch it. Look at what's happening. Things are getting ugly in Europe. And people are very aware of that. And even in Germany, you know, you've got internal battles now And the Social Democrats are saying, well, they're never going to become like the French, obviously. But the Social Democrats are saying, yeah, we have to pay attention to this. You know, it is about problems of inequality. And we as Germans need to do something more. We need to push for more investment. We need to, you know. So it's at least taking on board some of the economic arguments. But I guess the question is, do you go back or do you go forward? Can you go back to some kind of Marxian utopia? No, absolutely not. You've got to go forward. We exist in a neoliberal world, for better or for worse. So how do you get beyond this? We have exist with certain kinds of pension systems. So it really is tinkering at the margins of those those systems. But we don't see change now because we're in it. But it may very well be that 30 years hence, someone looking back will say, aha, that's the beginning of the new paradigm. Liberal economic expansionism. And you said, isn't this about risk aversion and costs, etc.? Well, this cost aversion, this is built into neoliberalism. You know, everyone wants low taxes. Well, you know, in Scandinavian countries, they're happy to pay a lot because they get a lot in return in terms of services, in terms of a more egalitarian society, despite the fact that Sweden has the highest growing inequality, second only to the US, in terms of income growth. Yeah, so also Sweden has been bitten by the neoliberal bug. But it's, you know, saying that this is all related to scarce resources, we create the scarceness of our own resources. If people wanted to share more, they would. If people knew that they would actually be getting good services, they might be willing to pay their taxes. And here, I'm not just thinking about Latin America, I'm thinking about Greece and Italy. So there's, you know, it may very well be that one needs to switch the way in which we think about these things. What is structural reform? Well, for the European Commission and for lots of people who are making policy for the program countries, you know, Portugal, Greece, etc. Structural reform means cutting spending, cutting pensions, deregulating labor markets, getting rid of job protections, etc. The problem with that, of course, is the Germans say, you know, do what we do. You know, we're competitive, you should be competitive. Well, they're competitive because they don't have flexible labor markets in the areas that count. They've got strong unions. Of course, they also have a completely dualized labor force so that the service workers are temporary part-time and getting nothing in terms of pensions. They're more, as precarious, if not more, than many Southern Europeans. But, you know, those workers that make for Germany's export competitiveness. Sorry, here I use that word again. Can't think of any other. That very thing that makes for their export competitiveness is what they're trying to destroy in Southern Europe. Big problem. How do you get beyond this? Well, maybe we need more indignados. Maybe we need more demonstrations from the left. But what we're getting is more demonstrations, more protests, and more elections of the extreme right. The populist right that makes an easy argument for coming, let's go back to nationalism, let's get rid of the euro, of European integration, and everything will be fine. Well, no. Europe then really will become the Disney park of the world, sort of an aging Disney park for the rest of the world. And its workers will then be going off to the BRICS and the emerging countries. To look for jobs. Where did you say you immigrated from? No, just a joke here. But I mean, in a way, it's already happening. You know, the Irish are leaving and then going to Australia and other places around the world, Singapore, etc. So I think this is really, so we need alternative ideas. Maybe these alternatives are actually being created. but we're not aware on the inequality, etc. Which five factors are predominant in terms of neoliberalism? It depends on where we're talking about. Yes, it may be on the interests, but the interests themselves, these interest groups, the businesses, politicians, are beginning to say, oh, wait a minute, maybe we've gone too far. But on the Washington consensus and all of that, how did a temporary remedy become a long-term concept? Well, yes. This is a matter for empirical research. And come tell me. But this is absolutely, you know, this is about the way in which a particular policy idea then becomes a program and perhaps a deep philosophy as it, you know, as it develops. You can talk about the institutionalization of certain ideas. So here we've got a couple of different possible explanations. And then I think I'm going to end my response by telling you what happened in a previous presentation of the book, which also speaks to some of your questions. And that is that in Italy, I think it was Florence, Giuliano Amato, former president, this former prime minister of Italy in the early 90s, says, Vivian, you know, this is all very, and Mark, this is all very nice and good, but isn't the term neoliberalism too big to fail? You know, it explains everything, so can it really explain? And he said, on top of that, you know, I become prime minister, I'm a social democrat, but I privatize, because that was the thing that you needed to do in order to make the economy work. So I responded, and I said, I have two responses to that. The first is, why you're not necessarily a neoliberal. You didn't think you were a neoliberal. You weren't a neoliberal ideologue. But those were the only ideas out there. The only thing you could do is privatize. No one said, oh, yeah, renationalize. You know, France tried that in 81. Didn't work so well. So, I mean, in a way, neoliberalism defined the range of ideas that were possible. That's one. And I said, but it is still a valid question to say, too big to bail. And for that, I said, the first time we ever presented, there was a University of Chicago professor who raised the same question. And then he said, you know, what about this dilution effect, so many different variants? He said, it reminds me of a gin cocktail. Think how different gin cocktails taste. You know, you can have martini, you can have a gimlet, which is with lime juice, you can have a gin and tonic. Those are, you know, diluted in very different ways. How can you say that this is all neoliberalism? So I sat there and for a minute and thought, what am I going to say here? And then I said, but actually, you're absolutely right to use the gym metaphor, and that, yes, it gets diluted. But then, all of a sudden, someone adds another shot of gin, and yet another. That's the nature of the resilience of neoliberalism. You start with Thatcher and Reagan in one kind of neoliberalism, and then, you know, Blair, Schroeder, Jospin come in with another kind of neoliberalism. And different sectors have different kinds. So they have different, you know, variations of cocktails, but of gin. But importantly, this is gin. This is neoliberalism. This is not scotch. This is not Marxism. And this is not rum. This is not populism. And I think that's the point. It's that we have been living since the 1980s, and you could argue even earlier in the 1970s, we have been living in a neoliberal world where the only ideas that come back in to reinforce, for the most part, are neoliberal. The big question is, what's going to happen next? Can Piketty and all those who are starting to say, but look at the inequality, can Piketty and all of those, and the indignados, more protest movements from the left. Are they the ones who are going to provide this new set of ideas? Or is it going to be from the extreme right? We did see it in the past in the 1930s. I hate to bring up that very bad memory. I don't think it's going to happen this time. But this could be a very dangerous moment. And it may very well be neoliberalism isn't going to be gotten rid of. But more likely than not, these new ideas will be layered on inequality will become such an issue that people will say, ha, maybe we do need a progressive income tax again. Maybe we do need to raise taxes on business. That's already beginning to happen. Maybe we do need to rethink pension systems. Maybe we need to think about how we deal with workers in the southern countries. Maybe we need the EU, and you can go on and on. But it seems to me that we could be at a turning point. Mm-hmm. There's an this is, I think, the last moment. Certainly for Europe, because if it goes on much longer, then the insane political administrative system that is the EU, it's not a government, will, you know, just elect a Marine Le Pen or Farage from UKIP or whatever. If they get control of any one government, then the EU stops. Or if increasing numbers. This is sort of a moment for change, an opportune moment, an important moment. If it's missed, and these things happen in history, we could be looking at something very bad for Europe. And then all I can say is, let's look to Chile. Let's look to Latin America for, you know, a new way of solving the problems of political economy and the welfare state and labor. And then maybe the Europeans will import that idea, as opposed to always the Europeans and the Americans sending out their own ideas. Thank you.
Thank you. That was exactly the question I asked, whether these new ideas could come from the South. Okay, well, thank you. Thank you very much, Vivian. I would like to give her a random applause, and then we close this seminar. And todos están cordialmente invitados a un pequeño compartir café afuera. Muchas gracias.